You treat yourself? Rowling shook his head. Came with a heist, he said. Zablonsky tut-tutted and wagged a finger under Rowling's nose. Get rid of it, Jim. Never keep anything from a job. Not worth the risk. Rowling considered, nodded, made his farewells, and left. John Preston had spent the entire day seeking out the various members of his investigative team to make his farewells. They were gratifyingly sorry to see him go. Then there was the paperwork. Bobby Maxwell had come in to say hello. Preston knew him vaguely. He was an agreeable enough young man, eager to make a career in five, and seeing his best chances of promotion as lying in a policy of hitching his wagon to the rising star of Brian Harcourt Smith. Preston could not hold that against him. He himself was a late entrant, having been inducted into the service direct from the Army Intelligence Corps in 1981 at the age of 41. He knew he would never get to the top. Head of section was about the limit for late entrants. Just occasionally, the post of the outgoing Director General went to someone from quite outside the service, if there was no obviously suitable candidate from within, always to the dismay of the people who worked in five. But the DDG, all the directors of the six branches, and most of the departments within the branches, were, by tradition, lifelong staffers. He had agreed with Maxwell that he would spend Monday finishing off his paperwork, and the whole of the next day briefing his successor on every current file and investigation. They had parted on that note with mutual good wishes until the morning. He glanced at his watch. It would be a late night. From his personal office safe he would have to get out every current file, check those that could safely go back to registry, and spend half the night going through the current bump page by page, ready to brief Maxwell in the morning. First, he needed a decent drink. He took the lift down to the sub-basement, where Gordon had a well-stocked and cosy bar. Louis Zablonsky worked through the whole of Tuesday, locked in his back room. Only twice did he have to emerge to see a customer personally. It was a slack day, for which, unusually, he was thankful. He worked with his jacket off and shirt sleeves rolled up over his almost hairless forearms, carefully easing the Glen Diamonds from their white-gold settings. The four principal stones, the 2 10-carat gems from the earrings and the matched pair from the tiara and the pendant, came easily and took little time. When they were out of their beds, he could examine them more closely. They were truly beautiful, flaming and sparkling in the light. They were already known to be blue-whites, once also called Top River, but now reclassified under the standardized GIA gradings as D Flawless. These four, when he had finished admiring them, he dropped into a small velvet bag. That done, he began the time-consuming task of easing the 40 smaller stones out of the gold. As he worked, the light occasionally caught a faded mark in the form of a five-figure number on the underside of his left forearm. To anyone who knew the significance of such marks, the number meant only one thing. It was the brand of Auschwitz. Zablonsky had been born in 1930, the third son of a Polish-Jewish jeweller of Warsaw. He was 9 when the Germans invaded, and by 1940 the ghetto of Warsaw had been enclosed. Incarcerated inside were close to 400,000 Jews, and rations were fixed at well below starvation level. On the 19th of April 1943, the 90,000 surviving ghetto inhabitants, led by a few able-bodied men left among them, rose in revolt. Louis Zablonsky was just turned 13, but so thin and emaciated he could well have appeared 5 years younger. When the ghetto finally fell to the Waffen-SS troops of General Jürgen Strupp on the 16th of May, he was one of the few who lived through the mass shootings. The bulk of the inhabitants, some 60,000, were already dead, from bullet, shot, shell, crushed beneath falling buildings, or executed. The remaining 30,000 were almost exclusively aged, with women and small children. Into these, Zablonsky was herded. Most went off to Treblinka and died. But in those freaks of circumstance that occasionally decide between life and death, the engine of the train hauling Zablonsky's cattle truck broke down. The truck was attached to another engine and ended up at Auschwitz. Though destined for death, he was spared when he gave his profession as jeweller, and was put to work sorting and classifying the trinkets still being found upon the persons of Jews in each fresh intake. Then one day he was summoned to the camp hospital, and into the hands of that smiling blond man whom they called the Angel, and who was still carrying out his manic experiments on the genitalia of pubescent Jewish youths. It was on Josef Mengele's operation table that, without anaesthetic, Louis Zablonsky was castrated. He tugged the last of the 40 smaller stones from the gold settings, and checked to see he had missed none. He counted the stones and began to weigh them, 40 in all, averaging half a carat, but mostly smaller. Engagement ring stuff, but about £12,000 in all. He could pass them through Hatton Garden, and no one the wiser. Cash deals, he knew his dealers. Then he began to crush the white gold settings into a shapeless mass. In late 1944, the survivors of Auschwitz were forced marched westwards, and Zablonsky ended up in Bergen-Belsen, where, more dead than alive, he was finally freed by the British Army. After intensive hospitalization, Zablonsky was brought to Britain, sponsored by a North London rabbi, and after further rehabilitation became a jeweler's apprentice. In the early 1960s, he left his employer and opened his own jewellery shop, first in the East End, and 10 years later, the present, more prosperous establishment in the West End. It was in the East End, down among the dockland, that he had first started to handle gems imported by seamen. Emeralds from Ceylon, diamonds from Africa, rubies from India, and opals from Australia. By the mid-1980s, he was a wealthy man from both his enterprises, the legitimate and the illicit, one of the top fences in London, a specialist in diamonds, with a large, detached house in Golders Green, and a pillar of his community there. When the white gold settings were a mangled blob of metal, he dropped the lump into his Lemel bag along with other scrap. He saw Sandra off the premises, closed the shop, tidied up his office, and left, taking the 4 primary stones with him. On the way home, he made a phone call from a public box to a number outside Antwerp in Belgium, a number situated in a small village called Nieland. When he got home, he rang British Airways and booked a flight for the morrow to Brussels. Along the shore of the River Thames, on its southern bank, where once had stood the rotting wharves of a dying dockland, a huge redevelopment program had been continuing through the early and mid-1980s. The program left great swathes of demolished rubble between the new buildings, moonscapes where the rank grass tangled with the fallen bricks and dust. One day it was intended all would be covered by the new apartment blocks, shopping malls, and multi-story car parks, but when that would be was anybody's guess. In warm weather, the winos camped out among these wastelands, and any South London face wishing to lose a piece of evidence had but to take the article to the centre of these abandoned places and burn it to extinction. Late on the evening of that Tuesday, the 6th of January, Jim Rawlings was walking across an area of several acres, stumbling in the dark as he tripped over unseen chunks of masonry. Had anyone been observing him, which they were not, they would have seen he carried in one hand a 2-gallon can of petrol, and in the other a beautiful, hand-crafted, calfskin attaché case. Louis Zablonsky went through Heathrow Airport on the Wednesday morning with no trouble. With heavy greatcoat and soft tweed hat, hand-grip and big briar pipe jutting from his jaw, he joined the daily flow of businessmen from London to Brussels. On the plane, one of the stewardesses leaned over him and whispered, "I'm afraid we can't allow you to light the pipe inside the cabin, sir." Zablonsky apologized profusely and stuffed the briar in his pocket. He did not mind. He did not smoke, and even if he had lit it, it would not have drawn very well, not with 4 pear-shaped 58-facet diamonds crammed into the base below the tamped tobacco. At Brussels National, he rented a car and headed north up the motorway out of Zaventem towards Mechelen, where he pulled right and northeast to Lier and Nieland. The bulk of the diamond industry in Belgium is centred around Antwerp, and is specifically located in and around the Pelikanstraat, where the big enterprises have their showrooms and workshops. But like most industries, the diamond business depends for a part of its functioning upon a mass of small suppliers and outworkers, one-man operations working out of their atelier, to whom can be subcontracted some of the manufacture of settings, cleaning and repolishing. Some of these outworkers also live in Antwerp, with the Jews, many of East European origin, predominant among them. But east of Antwerp lies an area known as Kempen, a cluster of neat villages in which are also located scores of these small workshops who undertake outwork for the Antwerp industry. In the centre of Kempen lies Nieland, astride the main road and rail lines from Leer to Herentals. Halfway down the Molenstraat lived one Raoul Levy, a Polish Jew who had settled in Belgium after the war, and who also happened to be a second cousin of Louis Oblonsky of London. Levy was a diamond polisher, a widower who lived alone in one of the small, neat, red-brick bungalows that lined the western side of the Molenstraat. At the back of the house was his workshop. It was to here that Oblonsky drove and met his relative a little after lunchtime. They argued for an hour and struck their deal. Levy would repolish the stones, losing as little of their weight as possible, but enough to disguise their identity. They settled at a fee of £50,000, half up front and half upon sale of the fourth stone. Oblonsky left and returned to London. The trouble with Raoul Levy was not that he lacked skill. It was that he was lonely. So each week he looked forward to his one expedition. He loved to take the train into Antwerp, go to his favourite café, where all his cronies met in the evenings, and talk shop. 3 days later he went there and talked shop, once too often. While Louis Oblonsky was in Belgium, John Preston was installing himself in his new office on the second floor. He was glad he did not have to leave Gordon for another building. His predecessor had retired at the end of the year, and the deputy head of C1A had been in charge for a few days, no doubt hoping he would be confirmed in the top man's post. He took his disappointment well, and briefed Preston copiously on what the job entailed, which seemed to Preston to be mainly grinding routine. Left alone that afternoon, Preston cast his eye down the list of ministry buildings that came under his Section A. It was longer than might be imagined, but most were not security-sensitive, save for leakages that might be politically embarrassing. Document leaks concerning, for example, intended social security cuts were always a hazard, since the civil service unions had recruited so many staffers with extreme-left political views, but they could usually be left to the ministry's in-house security people. The big ones for him were the Foreign Office, Cabinet Office, and Defence, all of which received cosmic-rated papers, but each had pretty tight security handled by its own internal security team. Preston sighed. He started to make a series of phone calls, setting up getting-to-know-you meetings with the security chiefs in each of the main ministries. Between calls, he glanced at the pile of personal stuff he had brought down from his old office 2 floors above. Waiting for a call back from some official otherwise engaged, he rose, unlocked his new personal safe, and put the files one by one inside. The last of them was his report of the previous month, his own personal copy. Other than the one he knew to be NFA'd in the registry, it was the only copy in existence. He shrugged and put it at the back of the safe. It would probably never be examined again, but he did not see why he should not keep it, for old time's sake. After all, it had taken a hell of a lot of sweat to put it together. Chapter 3. Moscow. Wednesday, the 7th of January, 1987. From H.A.R. Philby to General Secretary of the CPSU. Permit me to begin, Comrade General Secretary, with a brief outline of the history of the British Labour Party and its steady penetration and successful eventual domination by the hard left over the past 25 years. Only, I believe, on the basis of such a narration can the events of the past few years and those intended for the next few months be seen in their perspective. Since Hugh Gateschool was impregnated with the untraceable viral toxin that finally killed him, the development of Britain's Labour Party could hardly have followed a more hopeful course of development had its historical scenario been written here in Moscow. One must be quite aware, of course, that there always has been a dedicated, ardently pro-Soviet Marxist-Leninist wing deep within the Labour Party, but for most of the history of that party it was a tiny minority, and impotent to influence the course of events, the formation of policies, or, most importantly, the selection of candidates and the leadership of the party itself. So long as the party was under the commanding influence of the decisive Clement Attlee or the passionate Hugh Gaitskell, that situation was bound to continue. Both men staunchly maintained the proscribed list, under whose terms a whole range of bodies of Marxist-Leninist, Trotskyite or revolutionary persuasions were anathema to the Labour Party, and whose members were prohibited from joining the Labour Party, let alone standing for office within it. After Hugh Gaitskell, the man who at Scarborough, 1960, brought the party conference to its feet with his avowal to fight, fight, and fight again for the traditional soul of the party, died in January 1963, the leadership of the party passed into the hands of Harold Wilson, who held it for 13 years. He was a man dominated by two characteristics that had much to do with what happened to the party in those 13 years. Unlike Attlee, he possessed a great personal vanity of almost cosmic proportions, and unlike Gaitskell, he would go to almost any lengths to avoid a fight. Sensing this, our friends within the party began to undertake the long-awaited and immensely careful campaign to move deeper and in greater numbers into the party fabric. For some years this was hard, back-breaking work. Then, in 1972, our pro-Soviet friends on the National Executive Committee, hereafter called the NEC, tested the temperature of the water by helping to pass a resolution removing the Labour Research Department from the proscribed list. The Labour Research Department, despite its deliberately misleading name, had nothing to do with the Labour Party being a communist-controlled body. Happily, there was no backlash from the centrists to this move. The following year, 1973, the hard left on the NEC managed to abolish the proscribed list completely. The effect was beyond the dreams of the Marxist-Leninist group within the party. Few of them even then were spring chickens, most dated back to their original conversions to pro-Soviet Marxist-Leninism in the 30s. They needed to increase their numbers within the party. They knew many of their and our fellow travellers were excluded from party membership, and that there was a whole new generation of hard-left political activists looking for a political home. With the floodgates open, it was these, in all age groups, who now swarmed into the party ranks. With the passing of the years, most of the old stagers who kept the flame alight inside the party throughout the seemingly hopeless years of Attlee and Gaitskell have had to move into retirement. But they served their purpose. They opened the gates from the inside, and now it is the new generation, youthful 15 years ago but now mature, who form the hard left, and who have not simply a handsome share of the party, but have in effect taken it over at almost every level. Since 1973, the absolutely vital NEC has seldom been out of the hands of a hard-left majority, and it has been through the skilful use of this tool that the constitution of the party and its composition at the higher levels have been changed out of all recognition. A brief word of digression, Comrade General Secretary, to explain precisely whom I mean by our friends within the British Labour Party and trade union movement. They fall into two categories, the deliberate and the unwitting. With the first category, I am referring to people not of the so-called soft left, nor of the Trotskyite aberration, both of whom abhor Moscow, albeit for different reasons. I refer to those of the ultra-hard left. These are dedicated, dyed-in-the-wool Marxist-Leninists, who would not appreciate being called communists, since this implies membership of the quite useless British Communist Party. They are, nevertheless, staunch friends of Moscow, and in 9 cases out of 10 will act in accordance with Moscow's wishes, even though those wishes may remain unexpressed, and even though the person concerned will stoutly claim he was acting for conscientious or British reasons. The second group of friends, inside and now dominating the British Labour Party, the hard left, are as such. A person with a deep political and emotional commitment to a form of socialism so far left as to qualify as Marxist-Leninism, will, in any given set of circumstances or in any contingency, fortuitously react quite spontaneously in a manner completely parallel to or convergent with the desires of Soviet foreign policy vis-à-vis Britain and or the Western Alliance, a person who needs no briefing or instructions whatsoever, and who would probably be offended if such were proposed, a person who, wittingly or unwittingly, whether impelled by conviction, a warped patriotism, a desire to destroy, gain self-advancement, fear of intimidatory pressure, self-importance, or desire to move with the herd, will conduct himself in a manner that suits our Soviet interests perfectly. They all constitute agents of influence to our benefit. They all, of course, claim to be seekers after democracy. Happily, the overwhelming majority of Britishers today still understand by the word democracy a pluralist, multi-party state, whose governing body shall be chosen by universal adult suffrage based upon the secret ballot at periodic intervals. Obviously, our hard left friends over there, being people who eat, drink, breathe, sleep, dream, and work at left-wing policies every waking hour of every day, mean a democracy of the committed, with its controlling roles performed by themselves and like thinkers. The British press, fortunately, take few steps to correct this misapprehension. I must now mention, Comrade General Secretary, and dispose of, the issue which for many years divided the thrust of the hard left in the British Labour movement. This was the dichotomy of the two perceived roads to socialism that ran in parallel through hard-left thinking in Britain for decades and was only resolved in the climactic year of 1976, almost a decade ago to the day as I write. The twin and competing ways for the hard-left to progress inside Britain were for many years the parliamentary road to socialism and the industrial road to socialism. The first saw the better chances as lying in a steady takeover of the British Labour Party, which was then to be used as the instrument to gain power and produce the truly revolutionary society. The latter saw the better chance as lying in the mass mobilisation of the working class behind the trade union movement, the eventual bringing of that working class onto the streets, and the production of the revolutionary society that way. One should never forget that the true bedrock of Marxist-Leninism in Britain has always lain inside the trade union movement. For one thing, the union bedrock was always much more numerous than inside the Parliamentary Labour Party, which was why for years it was the trade union side that made all the running, culminating in the absolute peak of its power in 1976. By the time he returned to power in 1974, after the collapse of the Heath government, Wilson knew he could not take on the unions. If he confronted them, he split the party and lost office. By then, also, Britain was sinking fast, industrially, commercially, and financially, in face of union-engineered strikes, rising wage claims, falling productivity, spiralling unit costs, and sky-high personal taxation. By April 1976, Harold Wilson had lost control of the unions and the economy. The cataclysm was coming. The economists knew it. He resigned, announcing health reasons, and handed over to James Callaghan. By the late summer, Britain was heading straight towards bankruptcy and needed a large and fast loan from the International Monetary Fund. But the IMF was adamant. There had to be conditions. At that October's Labour Party conference, the British Chancellor of the Exchequer literally had to plead with the union barons for wage restraint and the acceptance of public sector spending cuts. Philby rose and walked to the window. He recalled that traumatic autumn well, and sighed regretfully. He had been a secret listener and closet adviser when the British trade unionists had made their contacts and had been instructed by Moscow what had to be done. It was a pity. Not since the Civil War of the 17th century, he knew, had Britain come closer to being in the grip of a revolutionary regime. Not since then had it been so close to complete extra-parliamentary rule. He returned to his typewriter. You will recall, with no less regret than I, that Moscow's advice had to be that the unions heed the Callaghan government's call for moderation. Within a fortnight, the union belligerency had collapsed to give way to the government-union-agreed social contract. To this day, the British themselves do not understand why. So just permit me to reiterate what must be known to you, since it has a bearing on what must follow. The Chancellor's plea had to be heeded, and the chance of bringing millions of workers onto the streets to confront their own army and police had to be abandoned. There was and remains one reason, and one reason only, for this. As Professor Krylov so persuasively argued then, all history teaches that soundly based democracies can only be toppled by mass action in the streets, when the police and armed forces have been sufficiently penetrated by the revolutionaries that large numbers of them can be expected to refuse to obey the orders of their officers and side instead with the demonstrators. And this was what was wrong with Britain. Despite repeated attempts over the years to secure the right to organize on a union basis, i.e. infiltrate union activists, this has never been achieved in Britain. It was calculated then, and I still think correctly, that the British soldiers and policemen would stay loyal to the Queen, throne, crown, call it what one will, and obey the orders of their officers. Had that happened, the attempt to change the course of British history from the streets instead of from the Houses of Parliament must have failed, and in failing must have set back the cause of our true friends by decades, if not half a century. Since then, further efforts have been made to remedy this lacuna in Britain's revolutionary possibilities and to establish trade union activism within the police and the armed forces, but to no avail. James Callaghan, a former consultant to the Police Federation, would have none of it. With the arrival of Margaret Thatcher in May 1979, the whole issue went out of the window. Our friends have done what they can. Since taking control of numerous large metropolitan authorities, through the press and the media, at every level, high and low, they have either themselves, or using the wild young people of the Trotskyite splinter factions as shock troops, carried out an unrelenting campaign to denigrate, vilify, and undermine the British police. The aim, of course, is to vitiate or destroy the confidence of the British people in their police, which unfortunately remains the most affable and disciplined in the world. The results have been patchy. There have been occasional successes in exploiting local grievances, genuine abuses in the areas of corruption or police brutality, and the occasional well-organized riot. But overall, the British working class remains infuriatingly wedded to the law and order issue, and the middle class still seems foursquare behind the police. I have narrated all this only to substantiate one argument: that the industrial road to socialism, the mass mobilization of millions on the streets to topple elective government, is as dead as a dodo. The path now lies through the parliamentary road. Quieter, more covert, but probably all in all more effective. It is this pursuit, over the succeeding years, of the parliamentary road to true revolutionary socialism that has now come to the threshold of success. It has come this far due to the largely successful campaign of the hard left to take over the Labour Party from inside, to several key changes in the party constitution, and to the success of the self-denying programme our true friends have forced themselves to adopt since the electoral disaster of 1983. With the diversion of the industrial road once disposed of in the autumn of 1976, our Marxist-Leninist friends in the Labour Party were able to devote themselves single-mindedly to the struggle to capture the party covertly, a programme made so feasible by the abolition of the proscribed list 3 years earlier. The Labour Party has always stood like a tripod on three legs: the trade unions, the constituency Labour parties, one each in the constituencies that make up the British electoral pattern, and the parliamentary Labour Party, the group of Labour MPs who were elected at the previous general election. The party leader is always drawn from among these. The trade unions are the most powerful of the three, and exercise this power in two ways. One, they are the party's paymasters, funding the coffers from political levies deducted from millions of workers' pay packets. Two, they dispose at party conference of huge block votes cast by the union national executive on behalf of millions of uncanvassed members. These block votes can ensure the passage of any resolution and elect up to a third of the party's all-important national executive committee. These vote-casting union executive committees are absolutely vital. They comprise the full-time union activists and officials who decide union policy. They stand at the peak of the pyramid, of which the middle ranks are the area officials and the lower ranks the branch officials. Thus, the effective takeover by hard-left activists of great swathes of trade union officialdom was clearly essential, and has, in fact, been achieved. The great ally of our friends in this task has always been the apathy of the largely moderate rank-and-file union members who cannot be bothered to attend union branch meetings. Thus, the activists who attend everything have been able to take over thousands of branches, hundreds of areas, and the cream of the national executive committees. At present, the biggest 10 of the 80 unions affiliated to the Labour Party control over half the union movement's votes. 9 of those 10 have hard left control at the top, as against 2 in the early 70s. All this has been achieved over the heads of millions of British workers by no more than 10,000 dedicated men. The importance of this hard left-dominated union vote will become plain when I describe the electoral college that chooses the new party leader. The unions hold 40% of the votes in this so-called college. Next, the constituency Labour parties, or CLPs. At the core of these lie the general management committees, which, apart from running the day-to-day business of the party within the constituency, have one other vital function. They choose the Labour candidate for Parliament. Over the decade 1973 to 1983, hardline activist young people of the extreme left began to move into the constituencies, and by assiduous attendance at dull and sparsely filled CLP meetings, ousted the old-time officials to gain control of one general management committee after another. As each successive constituency fell to the new hard-left activist control, the position of the largely centrist MPs representing these constituencies became tougher and tougher. Still, they could not be easily ousted. For the true triumph of the hard-left, it was necessary to weaken, indeed emasculate, the independence of conscience of a Member of Parliament, to transform him from the trustee of all his constituents' interests into a mere legate of his general management committee. This was brilliantly achieved by the hard left at Brighton in 1979, and with the passage of the new rule requiring the annual reselection or deselection of MPs by their management committees. The rule caused a massive switch of power. A whole group of centrists quit to form the Social Democratic Party. Others were deselected and left politics. Some of the ablest centrists were harassed into resignation. Still, the Parliamentary Labour Party, though emasculated and humiliated, was left with one vital function. The MPs, and they alone, could elect the Labour Party leader. It was crucial to complete the three-prong capture to take that power away from them. This was achieved, again at the urging of the hard left, in 1981, with the creation of the Electoral College, in which 30% of the votes are held by the Parliamentary Party, 30% by the constituency parties, and 40% by the trade unions. The college will elect each new leader as and when needed, and reconfirm him annually. This last function is crucial to the plans now afoot, and which I will describe. The struggle for control that I've described brings the story to the general election of 1983. The takeover was almost complete, but our friends had made two errors, aberrations from the Leninist doctrine of caution and dissimulation. They had come out too openly, too visibly, to win those titanic struggles, and the premature call for the general election caught them on the hop. The hard left needed one extra year to consolidate, mollify, unify. They did not get it. The party, saddled too early with the most extreme hard-left manifesto in history, was in complete disarray. Worse, the British public had seen the real face of the hard-left. As you will recall, the 1983 election was apparently a disaster for the by-now hard-left-dominated Labour Party. Yet, I suggest the outcome was in fact a blessing in disguise, for it led to the gritty and self-denying realism to which our true friends in the party have agreed to submit themselves over the past 40 months. Briefly, out of 650 constituencies in Britain in 1983, the Labour Party won only 209. But it was not quite as bad as it looked. For one thing, of those 209 sitting Labour MPs, 100 were now firmly on the left, 40 of them on the hard left. It may be small, but today's Parliamentary Labour Party is the furthest left that has ever sat in the House of Commons. Secondly, the defeat at the polls gave a jolt to those fools who thought the struggle for total control was already over. They soon realised that after the bitter but necessary struggles by our friends to win control of the party between 1979 and 1983, the time had come to re-establish unity and to repair the damaged power base in the country with an eye to the next election. This program began under hard-left orchestration at the October 1983 party conference and has been unswerving ever since. Thirdly, they all saw the necessity to return to that clandestinity demanded by Lenin of true believers operating inside a bourgeois society. Thus, the leitmotif of the whole span of the hard left's conduct these past 40 months has been a return to that clandestinity that worked so well through the early and mid-70s. This has been coupled with a reversion to an apparent and surprising degree of moderation. It has taken a vast effort in self-discipline to achieve this, but again, the comrades have not been found wanting in this regard. The hard left has effectively, since October 1983, taken on the clothes of courtesy, tolerance, and moderation. Stress is eternally laid upon the primordial importance of party unity, and a number of hitherto impossible concessions have been made in hard left dogma to achieve this. Both the centrist wing, delighted and amicable, and the media appear to have been completely taken in by the new, acceptable face of our Marxist-Leninist friends. More covertly, the takeover of the party has been finalized. All the lever committees are now either in the hands of the hard left or could be taken over within a single emergency meeting. But, and it is an important but, they have usually been content to leave the chairmanship of these lever committees in the hands of a soft left person, and even occasionally, when the voting supremacy is sufficiently overwhelming, in the hands of a centrist. The centrist wing, with the exception of about a dozen sceptics, has been effectively disarmed by the newfound unity and the absence of harassment of themselves. Nevertheless, the iron fist is still very much in the velvet glove. At constituency level, the takeover of local CLPs by hard-left elements has continued quietly and with very little public or media attention. The same thing has happened throughout the trade union movement, as I have already mentioned. 8 out of the Big 10 and half of the remaining 70 unions belong now to the hard left, and here again the profile has deliberately been kept much lower than prior to 1983. In summation, the entire Labour Party of Britain now belongs to the hard left, either directly, through soft left surrogates, through intimidated centrists, or at the holding of a fast emergency meeting of the appropriate committee, and yet neither the rank and file of the party membership, nor of the unions, nor of the media, nor the broad masses of the old Labour voters seem aware of it. For the rest, the hard left has for 40 months approached the next British general election like a military campaign. To win a simple majority in the British Parliament, it would need 325 seats, say 330. It possesses 210, which are regarded as in the bag. The other 120, lost in 1979 or 1983 or both, are regarded as winnable and have been designated target areas. It is a fact of political life in Britain that the people, after 2 full terms of one kind of government, often seem to think it is time for a change, even if the incumbent government is not really unpopular. But the British will only change if they trust what they are changing towards. It has been the aim of the Labour Party these past 40 months to win that trust back, albeit by subterfuge on the part of our friends within it. To judge by recent public opinion polls, the campaign has been substantially successful, for the percentage gap between the ruling Conservatives and the Labour Party has closed to a few points. Bearing in mind also that under the British system 80 marginal seats actually control the outcome of an election, and that the marginals are swung one way or the other by the 15% floating vote, the Labour Party has a chance of being returned at the next British general election as the government. In a succeeding and concluding memorandum, Comrade Secretary-General, I intend to show how, were that to happen, our friends of the hard left plan to topple Labour Party leader Neil Kinnock from the leadership in the hour of his victory and impose upon Britain her first Marxist-Leninist premier, along with a truly revolutionary socialist legislative programme. Yours sincerely, Harold Adrian Russell Filby. Chapter 4. The men, when they came to visit Raoul Levy, were 4 in number. Big, heavy men who arrived in 2 cars, The first car cruised to a halt outside Levy's bungalow in the Molenstraat, while the second halted 100 yards up the street. The first car disgorged two of the men, who walked briskly but quietly up the short drive to the front door. The two drivers waited, lights doused, engines running. It was a bitter night, just after 7 p.m, pitch dark, and no one walked Molenstraat that evening of the 15th of January. The men who knocked on the front door were brisk and businesslike, as men with little time to waste, a job to do, and the opinion that the sooner it was over, the better. They did not introduce themselves when Levy answered the door. They just stepped inside and pulled the door closed behind them. Levy's protest was hardly out of his mouth when it was cut off by four rigid fingers jabbing into his solar plexus. The big man pulled his overcoat around his shoulders, clapped his hat on his head, left the front door on the latch, and walked him expertly down the drive to the car, whose rear door opened as they approached. When they drove off, with Levy sandwiched between them and the rear seat, they had taken 20 seconds. They took him to the Kesselse Heide, a big public park just northwest of Nieuwen, whose 50 acres of heather, grass, oaks, and mixed conifers were completely deserted. Well off the road, in the heart of the heath, the two cars stopped. The driver from the second vehicle, who was to be the interrogator, slipped into the front passenger seat. He turned towards the rear of the car and nodded to his two colleagues. The one on Levy's right swept two arms around the small diamond polisher to hold him still, and the gloved hand of one arm went across Levy's mouth. The other man produced a pair of heavy pliers, took Levy's left hand, and deftly crushed three knuckles, one after the other. What frightened Levy more even than the shattering pain was that they did not ask him any questions. They seemed uninterested. When the fourth finger knuckle pulped in the pliers, Levy was screaming to be asked questions. The interrogator in the front nodded casually and said, "Want to talk?" Behind the glove, Levy nodded furiously. The glove was removed. Levy let out a long, bubbling scream. When he had finished, the interrogator said, "The diamonds from London. Where are they?" He spoke Flemish, but with a marked foreign accent. Levy told him without delay. There was no money that could compensate for losing his hands and his livelihood. The interrogator considered the information soberly. "Keys," he said. They were in Levy's trouser pocket. The interrogator took them and left the car. Seconds later, the second saloon crunched away across the crackling grass towards the road. It was gone 50 minutes. During that time, Levy whimpered and held his ruined hand. The men on either side of him seemed uninterested in him. The driver sat and stared ahead, gloved hands on the wheel. When the interrogator rejoined them, he made no mention of the four gems that by now were in his pocket. He just said, "One last question. The man who brought them?" Levy shook his head. The interrogator sighed, the waste of time, and nodded to the man on Levy's right. The heavy men reversed roles. The one on the right took the pliers and Levy's right hand. After the crushing of two knuckles on that hand, Levy told them. The interrogator had a couple of short supplementary questions, and then he seemed satisfied. He left the car and went back to his own. In convoy, the two saloons bumped back towards the road. They drove back to Nieuwen. As they went past his house, Levy saw that it was dark and closed. He hoped they would drop him off there, but they did not. They drove through the centre of the town and out to the east. The lights of the cafes, warm and snug against the freezing winter air, went past the car windows, but no one came running out. Levy could even see the blue neon word Politi above the police station across from the church, but no one came out. 2 miles to the east of Nieuwen, the Looistraat crosses the rail lines at a point where the Leo to Herentals tracks run straight as a narrow, and the big diesel-electric locos go through at over 70 miles per hour. Either side of the level crossing are farm buildings. Both cars stopped short of the level crossing and doused lights and engines. Without a word, the driver opened the glove compartment, produced a bottle, and handed it back to his two colleagues. One held Levy's nose closed, and the other poured the white grain spirit of a local brand down the gagging throat. When 3/4 of it was gone, they stopped and left him alone. How Levy began to drift away in an alcoholic daze. Even the pain eased a bit. The three men in the car, and the one ahead of them, just waited. At 11:15, the interrogator came from the first car and muttered something through the window. Levy was unconscious by then, but moving fitfully. The one beside him hauled him out of the car and half-carried him towards the tracks. At 11:20, one of them hit him hard on the head with an iron bar, and he died. They laid him on the tracks with his shattered hands on one of the rails and his broken head near it. Hans Robillard took the last express of the night out of Lier at 23:09 exactly, as always. It was a routine run, and he would be home in his warm bed in Herentals by 1 o'clock. It was a non-stop freight loco, and he went through Nieland on time at 23:19. After the crossings there, he piled on the power and went down the straight towards the Leustrat crossing at close to 70 miles per hour, the spotlight of the 6268 lighting up the track for 100 yards ahead. Just short of Leustrat, he saw the huddled figure lying on the track and slammed on his brakes. Sheets of sparks flew out from his wheels. The freight train began to slow, but nowhere near enough. Mouth open, he watched through the windscreen as the headlight flew towards the crumpled figure. 2 men in the yard had had it happen to them before, suicides or drunks. No one ever knew, not afterwards. With this kind of rig, you don't even feel the thud, they had said. He didn't. The screaming loco flashed over the spot and was still doing 30 miles per hour. When he finally stopped, he could not even look. He ran to one of the farms and raised the alarm. When the police came with lanterns, the mess under his wheels looked like strawberry jam. Hans Robillard did not reach home until dawn. That same morning, but 4 hours later, John Preston entered the lobby of the Ministry of Defence in Whitehall, approached the desk, and used his universal pass to identify himself. After the inevitable check call to the man he had come to see, he was led up in the lift and down several corridors to the office of the Ministry's Head of Internal Security, a room high at the back of the building overlooking the Thames. Brigadier Bertie Capstick had changed little since Preston had last seen him, years ago in Ulster. Big, florid, and genial, with apple cheeks that made him look more like a farmer than a soldier, he came forward with a roar of, "Johnny, my boys, I live and breathe. Come in, come in." Although only 10 years older than Preston, Bertie Capstick had a habit of calling almost anyone his junior, "my boy," which gave him an avuncular air, matched by his appearance. But he had been a tough soldier once, moving deep into terrorist territory during the Malay campaign, and later commanding a group of infiltration experts in the jungles of Borneo during what was now called the Indonesian Emergency. Capstick sat him down and produced a bottle of single malt from a filing cabinet. "That's your snort." "A bit early," protested Preston. It was just past 11 o'clock. "Nonsense, for old time's sake. Anyway, the coffee they bring you here is abysmal." Capstick sat himself down and pushed the glass towards Preston across his desk. "So, what have they done with you, my boy?" Preston grimaced. "I told you on the phone what they've given me," he said. "Bloody policeman's job. No disrespect to you, Bertie."
"Well, same with me, Johnny. Out to grass. Of course, I'm an R.O., retired officer now, so I'm not too bad. Took my pension at 55, managed to get this slot. Not too bad. Potter up in the train every day, check up on all the security routines, make sure no one's been a bad lad, and go home to the little woman. Could be worse. Anyway, here's the old days."
"Cheers," said Preston. They both drank. The old days had not been quite as genial as that, thought Preston. When last he had seen Bertie Capstick, then a fool colonel, almost 6 years ago, the deceptively extroverted officer had been Deputy Director of Military Intelligence in Northern Ireland, working out of that complex of buildings at Lisburn whose data banks can tell the inquirer which IRA man had scratched his backside recently. Preston had been one of his boys, working in civilian clothes and undercover, moving through hardline Provo ghettos to talk with informers or pick up packets from dead drops. It was Bertie Capstick who had loyally stuck by him in the face of the wittering civil servants from Holyrood House when Preston was burned and nearly killed while on a mission for Capstick. It was the 28th of May, 1981, and the papers carried a few sparse details the following day. Preston had been in an unmarked car and had entered the Bogside district in Londonderry on his way to a meet with an informer. Whether there had been a leak higher up, whether the car he was driving had been used once too often, or whether his face had been made by the Provo intelligence people, was never later established. Whatever, there was a foul-up. Just as he had entered the Republican stronghold, a car containing four armed provos had pulled out from a side street and followed him. He had spotted them quickly in his mirror and called off the rendezvous at once. But the provisionals wanted more than that. Deep inside the ghetto, they swerved across his front and came tumbling out of their own car, two with armalites and one with a pistol. With nowhere to go but heaven or hell, Preston took the initiative. Against the odds, and to the consternation of his attackers, he came out of his own door in a fast roll, just as the armalites riddled his vehicle. He had his Browning 13-shot 9mm in his hand, set to automatic. From the cobblestones, he let them have it. They had expected him to die decently. They were too close together. On rapid fire, he had dropped two dead in their tracks and blown a chunk out of the neck of the third. The Provo driver had let in his clutch and disappeared in a plume of burning tires. Preston had made his way to a safe house, staffed by four SAS troopers, who kept him until Capstick arrived to bring him home. Of course there had been the devil to pay. Inquiries, interrogations, worried questions from on high. There was no question of his going on. He had been well and truly burned, to use the term of art, that is, identified. His usefulness was over. The surviving Provo would know his face again anywhere. They would not even let him go back to his old regiment, the Paras at Aldershot. Who knew how many Provos hung around Aldershot? They had offered him Hong Kong or the exit door. Then Bertie Capstick had had a talk with a friend. There was a third choice. Leave the army as a 41-year-old major and become a late entrant into MI5. He had gone for that one.
"Anything particular?" asked Capstick.
Preston shook his head. "Just a round of getting-to-know-you calls," he said. "Don't worry, Johnny. Now I know you're in the seat, I will call if anything crops up here that looks bigger than swiping the Christmas fund. How's Julia, by the way?"
"I'm afraid she's left me 3 years ago."
"Oh, I'm sorry to hear that." Bertie Capstick's face puckered in genuine concern.
"Another fella?"
"No, not then. There's someone now, I think. Just the job, you know?"
Capstick nodded grimly.
"I bet he's always been very good like that," he ruminated. "Been away from home half my life. She always stuck by, kept the fire burning. Still, no life for a woman. Seen it happen before, many times. Still, bad luck. See the boy?"
"Now and again," admitted Preston.
Capstick could not have struck a more raw nerve. In his small and lonely South Kensington flat, Preston kept two photographs. One showed him and Julia on their wedding day, he at 26, trim in his parachute regiment uniform, she at 20, beautiful and white. The other was of his son, Tommy, who meant more to him than life itself. They had lived a normal army life in a succession of married quarters, and Tommy had been born 8 years later. The arrival had fulfilled John Preston, but not his wife. Soon after, Julia had begun to get bored by the chores of motherhood, compounded by the loneliness of his absences, and she had begun to complain of the lack of money. She chivied him to leave the army and earn more in civilian life, refusing to understand that he loved his job and that the boredom of a desk in commerce or industry would have driven him to distraction. He transferred to the Intelligence Corps, but that made it worse. They sent him to Ulster, where wives could not follow. Then he went underground, and all contact was broken. After the Bogside incident, she really made her feelings plain. They gave it one more try, living in the suburbs while he worked at Five, returning almost every evening to Sydenham. That had solved the separation question, but the marriage had gone sour. Julia wanted more than his salary, starting out as a late entrant in Five, could provide. She had taken a job as a receptionist at a fashion house in the West End when Tommy, aged 8, had gone at her insistence to a local fee-paying school near their hometown. That had strained the finances even more. A year later she had left completely, taking Tommy with her. Now he knew she was living with her boss, old enough to be her father, but able to keep her in style, and Tommy at a boarding preparatory school at Tunbridge. Now he hardly ever saw the 12-year-old lad. He had offered her a divorce, but she did not want one. With 3 years of separation, he could have got the divorce anyway, but she had threatened that as he could not provide for the boy and pay maintenance as well, she would settle for Tommy. He was cornered, and he knew it. She allowed him to have Tommy for 1 week in each holiday and one exeat Sunday each term.
"Well, I must be going, Bertie. You know where I am if anything big blows up?" Of course. Of course.
Bertie Capstick lumbered to the door to see him out. Take care of yourself, Johnny. There aren't many of us good guys left anymore. They parted on a jocular note, and Preston went back to Gordon Street. Louis Oblonsky knew the men who arrived in a van and knocked on his front door late that Saturday night. He was alone in the house as usual on Saturdays. Beryl was out and would not return until the small hours. He supposed they knew that. He had been watching the late film on television when the knock came, and thought nothing of it. He answered the door, and they bulled straight into the hallway, closing the door behind them. There were three of them. Unlike the four who had visited Raoul Levy 2 days earlier, an incident of which he knew nothing as he did not read the Belgian papers, these were muscle hire from London's East End, slags in underworld parlance. Two were brutes, simple stake-faced thugs who would do anything they were told and obey the orders of the third. He was slight, pocked, mean, with dirty blonde hair. Zablonsky did not know them personally, he just knew them. He had seen them in the camps, in uniform. The knowledge sapped his will to resist. He understood there was no point. Men like this always did what they wanted to people like him. There was no point in resisting or appealing. They pushed him back into the sitting room and threw him into his own armchair. One of the big men stood behind the chair, leaned forward and pinned Zablonsky into it. The other stood by, caressing one fist with the palm of the other. Blonde hair drew up a stool in front of the chair, squatted on it, and stared at the jeweller's face. "Hit him," he said. The slag to Zablonsky's right swung a heavy fist straight into his mouth. The man was wearing brass knuckles. The front of the jeweller's mouth dissolved in a welter of teeth, lips, blood and gum. Blondie smiled. "Not there," he chided gently. "He's supposed to talk, isn't he? Lower down." The thug slammed two more haymakers into Zablonsky's chest. Several ribs cracked. From Zablonsky's mouth came a high-pitched keening. Blondie smiled again. He liked it when they made a noise. Zablonsky struggled feebly, but he might as well not have bothered. The muscled arms from behind the chair held him fast, as the other arms had held him down on that stone table so long ago in southern Poland, while the blonde man smiled down at him. "You've been bad, Louis," crooned Blondie. "You upset a friend of mine. He reckons you've got something of his, and he wants it back." He told the jeweller what it was. Zablonsky choked back some of the blood that filled his mouth. "Not here," he croaked. Blondie considered. "Search the place," he told his companions. "He won't give no trouble. Take it apart." The two slags searched the house, leaving Blondie with the jeweller in the sitting room. They were thorough, and it took an hour. When they had finished, every closet, cupboard, drawer, nook and cranny had been turned out. Blondie contented himself with poking the old man in his broken ribs. Just after midnight, the slags returned from the attic. "Nothing," said one.
"So, who's got it, Louis?" asked Blondie.
He tried not to tell them, so they hit him again and again until he did. When the one behind the chair released him, he fell forward onto the carpet and rolled onto one side. He was going blue round the lips, his eyes starting and his breath coming in short, laboured gasps. The three men looked down at him.
"He's having a heart attack," said one curiously. "He's croaking." "Hit him too hard then, didn't you?" said Blondie sarcastically. "Come on, let's go. We've got the name."
"You reckon he was telling us straight?" asked one of the slags.
"Yeah. He was telling us straight an hour ago," said Blondie.
The three left the house, clambered into their van, and drove off. On the road south from Golders Green, one of the slags asked Blondie, "So what are we going to do now, then?"
"Shut up, I'm thinking," said Blondie.
The little sadist liked to think of himself as a commander of criminals. In fact, he was of limited intelligence and was in a quandary. On the one hand, the contract had been to visit just one man and recover some stolen property. On the other, they had not recovered it. Near Regent's Park, he saw a telephone booth.
"Pull over," he said. "I've got to make a phone call."
The man who'd hired him had given him a telephone number, another phone booth, and three specific hours at which to call. The first of them was only a few minutes ahead.
Beryl Zablonsky returned from her Saturday evening treat just before 2 in the morning. She parked her metro across the street and let herself in, surprised to see the lights still on. Louis Zablonsky's wife was a nice Jewish girl of working-class origins who had early learned that to expect everything in life is stupid and selfish. 10 years earlier, when she was 25, Zablonsky had plucked her from the second-row chorus line of a no-hope musical and asked her to marry him. He had told her about his inability, but she had accepted him notwithstanding. Strangely, it had been a good marriage. He had been immeasurably kind and treated her like a too indulgent father. She doted on him, almost as a daughter. He had given her everything he could, a fine house, clothes, trinkets, pocket money, security. And she was grateful. There was one thing, of course, he could not give her. But he was understanding and tolerant. All he asked was that he never knew who, or be asked to meet one. At 35, Beryl was a trifle overripe, a little obvious, earthy and attractive in that kind of way that appeals to younger men, a sentiment she heartily reciprocated. She maintained a small studio flat in the West End for her trysts, and unashamedly enjoyed her Saturday night treats. 2 minutes after entering the house, Beryl Zablonsky was crying and giving her address down the telephone to the ambulance service. They were there 6 minutes later, put the dying man on a stretcher, and tried to hold him in this life all the way to the Royal Free. Beryl went with him in the ambulance. On the way, he had one brief period of lucidity, and beckoned her close to his bleeding mouth. Craning an ear, she caught his few words, and her brow wrinkled in puzzlement. It was all he ever said. By the time they got to Hampstead, Louis Zablonsky was another of the knight's dead-on-arrival cases. Beryl Zablonsky still retained a soft spot for Jim Rawlings. She had had a brief affair with him 7 years earlier, before his marriage. She knew his marriage had now broken up, and that he was living alone again in the top-floor apartment in Wandsworth, whose telephone number she had called often enough to have memorized it. When she came on the line, she was still crying, and at first Rawlings had some trouble, dazed with sleep as he was, in making out who was calling. She was ringing from a public booth in the casualty admissions department, and the pips kept going as she put in fresh coins. When he understood who it was, Rawlings listened to the message with increasing puzzlement. "That's all he said. Just that. All right, love. Look, I'm sorry. Really very sorry. I'll come out when the fuzz have cleared out. See if there's anything I can do. Oh, and Beryl, thanks." Rawlings replaced the receiver, thought for a moment, and placed 2 calls, one after the other. Ronnie from the scrapyard reached him first, and Sid was there 10 minutes later. Both, as instructed, were tooled up. They were just in time. The visiting party tramped up the 8 flights of stairs 15 minutes later. Blondie had not wanted to take the second contract, but the extra money the voice on the phone had guaranteed was too much to turn down. He and his mates were East Enders and hated to go south of the river. The animosity between the gangs of the East End and the South London mobs is legendary in the capital's underworld, and for a southerner to up east uninvited, or the reverse, can be a ticket to a lot of trouble. Still, Blondie reckoned that at 3:30 in the morning things should be quiet enough, and he could be back in his own manor with a job done before he was spotted. When Jim Rawlings opened his door, a heavy hand shoved him straight back down the corridor leading to his sitting room. The 2 slags came in first, with Blondie bringing up the rear. Rawlings backed fast down the corridor to let them all in. When Blondie slammed the door behind him, Ronnie came out of the kitchen and levelled the 1st slag with a pickaxe handle. Sid came out of the coats cupboard in a rush and used a nail bar on the cranium of the 2nd man. Both went down like oxen. Blondie was scrabbling at the door catch, trying to get back out to the safety of the landing, when Rawlings, stepping over the bodies, caught him by the scruff and slammed him face first into a glass-fronted portrait of the Madonna, the nearest the little man had ever come to organized religion. The glass broke, and Blondie collected several small shards in his cheeks. Ronnie and Sid tied up the 2 heavies while Rawlings hauled Blondie into the sitting room. Minutes later, held at the feet by Ronnie and round the waist by Sid, Blondie was protruding several feet out of the picture window, 8 floors above the ground. "See that car parked down there?" Rawlings asked him. Even in the blackness of a winter night, the man could just make out the glint of streetlights on cars a long way down. He nodded. "Well, in 20 minutes that car park's going to be full of fuzz,
standing around a plastic sheet. And guess who's going to be under it, all squashed and nasty?
Blondie, aware his life expectancy was now measurable in seconds, called from his extremity,
"All right, I'll cough."
They brought him in and sat him down. He tried to be ingratiating.
"Look, we know the score, Squire. I was just hired to do a job, right? Recover something what got nicked."
"Old man in Golders Green," said Rawlings.
"Yeah, well, he said you got it, so I came here."
"He was a mate of mine. He's dead."
"Well, I'm sorry, Squire. I didn't know he had a heart condition. The boys only tapped him a couple of times."
"You crap eater. His mouth was all over the parish and all his ribs cracked."
"So what did you come for?"
Blondie told him.
"The what?"
asked Rawlings incredulously. Blondie told him again.
"Don't ask me, Squire. I was just paid to get it back. Or find out what happened to it."
"Well," said Rawlings, "I'm very close to having you and your mates in the Thames before sunup wearing a nice new line of concrete underpants. Only I don't need the aggro, so I'm letting you go. You tell Punter it was empty, completely empty, and I burned it to a cinder. There's nothing left of it.
You don't really think I'll keep something taken from a job? I'm not a complete fool. Now get out."
At the doorway, Rawlings called Ronnie back.
"See him back across the river, and give the little rat a present from me for the old man, okay?"
Ronnie nodded. Minutes later, down in the car park, the more damaged of the EastEnders went into the back of his own van, still trussed up. The half-conscious one was put behind the steering wheel with hands untied and told to drive. Blondie was thrown in the front passenger seat, his broken arms in his lap. Ronnie and Sid followed them to Waterloo Bridge, then turned back and went home. Jim Rawlings was perplexed. He made himself a cup of espresso and thought things over. He had indeed intended to burn the attaché case among the rubble, but it was so beautifully hand-tooled. The dull, burnished leather glowed in the light of the flames like metal. He had examined it for any sign of an identification mark. There was none. Against his better judgment and the warning of Zablonsky, he had decided to risk keeping it. He went to a high cupboard and brought it down. This time he went over it as a professional cracksman. It took him 10 minutes to find the stud on the hinge side of the case that slid sideways when pushed hard with the ball of the thumb. From inside the case he heard a sound. When he reopened the case, the base had risen half an inch at one side. With a paper knife he eased up the base and glanced inside the flat compartment between the case's real base and the false one. With tweezers he extracted the 10 sheets of paper that lay within. Rawlings was no expert on government documents, but he could understand the rubric of the Ministry of Defence, and the words "top secret" are understandable in any man's language. He sat back and whistled softly. Rawlings was a burglar and a thief, but like much of the London underworld, he would not have anyone rubbish his country. It is a fact that convicted traitors in prison, along with child molesters, have to be kept in seclusion because professional faces, if left alone with such a man, are likely to rearrange his component parts. Rawlings knew whose apartment he had burgled, but the robbery had not been reported yet, and he suspected, for reasons he could only now fathom, that it might never be. So he did not need to draw attention to it. On the other hand, with Zablonsky dead, the diamonds were probably gone forever, and his cut of their value with it. He began to hate the man who owned that apartment. He had already handled the papers without gloves, and he knew his own prints were on file. He dared not identify himself, so he had to wipe the papers clean with a cloth, erasing the traitor's fingerprints as well. That Sunday afternoon, he mailed a plain brown envelope, well sealed and with an excess of stamps, from a postbox in the Elephant and Castle. There was no collection until Monday morning, and the package did not arrive until the Tuesday. That day, the 20th of January, Brigadier Bertie Capstick came on the phone to John Preston at Gordon. The bluff geniality of his voice was gone.
"Johnny, remember what we were talking about the other day? If anything cropped up. Well, it has, and it's not the Christmas fund. It's big, Johnny.
Someone has mailed me something in the post. No, not a bomb. That might turn out worse. It looks as if we have a leak here, Johnny. And he has to be very, very high. That means it comes under your department. I think you'd better come down and take a look. That morning also, in the owner's absence, but by appointment and letting themselves in with provided keys, two workmen arrived at an eighth-floor apartment at Fontenoy House. During the day, they chipped the damaged Hamber safe out of the wall and replaced it with an identical model. By nightfall, they had redecorated the wall as it had been before. Then they left. Chapter 5. It was not until Monday, the 19th of January, that Harold Filby, with the boys back at school and Erita out shopping, felt able to write out the final draft of his second memorandum to the General Secretary of CPSU. He had had no word to acknowledge the receipt of the first monograph, nor any indication of how it had been viewed. It would depend on his climactic revelations in the second paper to bring the Soviet leader to the view the writer sought. From H.A.R. Filby to General Secretary of the CPSU. To conclude my two-part response to your request of New Year's Eve, on the 7th of May, 1981, millions of Londoners went to the polls to elect a new Greater London Council. The incumbent ruling group on the GLC was then the Conservatives, under the leadership of Sir Horace Cutler. The Labour group was seeking election under the leadership of Mr. Andrew McIntosh, a hugely popular centrist Labour politician of traditional Labour values. The polls closed, and after the vote count, it was revealed that Labour had won. McIntosh was the new leader of the GLC. Within 16 hours, not days or weeks or months, but 16 hours, Andrew McIntosh was deposed from the Labour leadership in a closed-doors meeting of the Labour group's inner caucus and replaced by a far-left activist called Ken Livingstone, of whom not more than 5% of Londoners had ever heard. It was a truly brilliant coup, of which Lenin himself would have been proud. It had taken not hours, but weeks and months to cobble together the alliance of hard-left delegates from the boroughs who formed the wafer-thin majority that toppled McIntosh, and most of the credit must go to Livingstone himself. Although a nondescript, instantly forgettable little fellow with a nasal voice, Livingstone has shown himself to be a consummate politician in the far-left mould. A full-time operator since his teens, content to live, at least until his appearance as leader of the GLC, in a tiny bedsitter flatlet, devoid, it would seem, of any social, leisure, or family life, he lives, eats, and breathes politics 24 hours in every day. There is no meeting so apparently unimportant that he will not attend and give his blessing and an address, so long only as there is a chance of making one fresh favour, or influencing one fresh delegate vote which may later come in useful. As a result, using his base in County Hall as a springboard, he has managed in 5 years to build up a personal far-left political machine that now spans the whole country, its tendrils far beyond the confines of London. Now a Member of Parliament, as he has been since last year, he has effectively superseded Anthony Wedgwood Benn. A brilliant committee management man, he has become a leading mover in the hard-left capture of the British Labour Party. I retail all this because the Livingstone coup d'etat is the model upon which is to be based the final takeover of the Labour Party leadership, not before its electoral triumph, but a few days after it. Nor are the words coup d'etat an exaggeration. Greater London has over 11 million people, 20% of Britain's population. It is as big as Liechtenstein or Luxembourg, i.e. a mini-state, and has a budget bigger than that of 80 of the 150 nations represented at the United Nations. Now to specifics. Within the heart of the hard left of the British Labour Party and trade union movement, there is a group of 20 who, together, may be said to represent the ultra-wing. They cannot be called a committee, because although in touch with each other, they seldom, if ever, meet in one place. Each has spent a lifetime working his way slowly upwards in the inner apparatus. Each has at his fingertips a manipulative influence far, far beyond his apparent office or position. Each is a totally committed, true believer, Marxist-Leninist. There are 20 in all, 19 men and one woman. 9 are trade unionists, 6, including the woman, sitting Labour MPs, plus 2 academics, a peer, a lawyer, and a publisher. These are the ones who will trigger and stage manage the takeover.